The headlines: crowds of people attend a funeral procession for the victims of a recent terrorist attack in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz. Iran says U.S. sanctions are blocking the import of food and medicine in the breach of a ruling by the International Court of Justice. Also ahead, Russia warns against the U.S. deployment of modernized nuclear weapons across Europe. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gitumish Ahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. A funeral procession has taken place in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz for the victims of a recent terror attack on a holy shrine there. Thousands of mourners turned out for the funeral service. They chanted slogans condemning terrorism and those behind the heinous crime. At least 13 people were confirmed dead in the Wednesday terrorist attack, among them women and children. Over 24 were also wounded. A gunman started shooting from one of the entrances of the shrine. He then headed to the main compound, firing at pilgrims and staff. The assailant was finally injured by security forces and later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the United States and Israel have hatched a sinister plot to incite the recent riots across the country. Major General Hossein Salami was speaking at a funeral procession of the victims of the Wednesday terror attack in Shiraz. He said the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia are desperate about their back-to-back defeats in West Asia, including in Yemen. Salami said those behind Iran's riots cannot tolerate the Islamic Republic's political and spiritual influence across the region. Therefore, he added that they have resorted to provoking unrest inside Iran, but to no avail. The military official also said that Washington has a long history of making attempts to weaken Iran, referring to U.S. sanctions as a case in point. Salami added that Iran has successfully overcome hurdles caused by those sanctions. Researcher and activist Hossein Chekhian says the recent wave of unrest and rioting in Iran opened a window of opportunity for those behind the Shiraz terror attack.
The terrorist attacks take place if the security of the society is harming, if the security forces are busy doing something else, some people like ISIS members could have the opportunity to attack some shrines or some places around the cities of Iran. So we have to confront it, I think, in the media. In this past 40 days, we have been such a harmful atmosphere for Iran's picture and image in whole world, because all the CIA medias, I mean, all the Mossad medias, all the Saudis medias, are together planned a war, a really soft, a really hard soft war, should we say, against the people of Iran. And it brings up such an attack.
Masoud Shajari is the chairman of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia are behind the recent riots in Iran.
The reality is that the Saudis and the Israelis and the Americans for a very long time saying that they're going to bring their fight into Iran and create sort of disharmony and indeed instability. This is something that if anyone studies the speeches and the statement from these entities, will be in no doubt that that has been the plan. The fact of the matter is that this is the sort of opportunities that they use. They try to sort of back the sort of concern of innocent people coming out and sort of demonstrating legitimately according to the legal status and indeed according to the constitution of Iran. But they back that, they back up, they sort of back ride this innocent concern of the citizens of Iran, and they turn it into riots, they turn it into instability, they turn it into creating sort of instability from a security point of view.
Iran says U.S. sanctions have prevented its imports of food and medicine. Iran says this is against a ruling by the International Court of Justice mandating what Washington exempts as food and medicine from the bans. Iran's deputy U.N. ambassador Zahra Ershadi says the U.S. has failed to comply with the court order. She says the U.S. has even imposed additional sanctions on Iran, openly defying the judgment. Ershadi made the statement while speaking during a UNGA debate on the International Court of Justice. The U.S. has launched a campaign of maximum pressure on Iran since former President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Under the policy, Washington reimposed unilateral sanctions that were removed under the accord. Political commentator Scott Bennett earlier shared his thoughts on the issue. Let's take a listen.
It is a crime against humanity. It's a crime of genocide. It's a weapon of genocide. Of course, this shouldn't surprise us, first of all, from the political leadership of a country that has killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children under Madeleine Albright, that has killed children in, of course, the Iraq-Iran war with the chemical weapons that the United States supplied to Iraq. And now we see the United States also killing the children and elderly senior citizen people in Ukraine by empowering the fanatical maniacs of the woke left in the Nazi tattooed uniform of Zelensky's regime to bomb and engage in genocide. So it shouldn't surprise us that there's no moral restraint or sanity or decency in the Western hegemonic obsessionists in the political and military class. This should, of course, be brought up to the entire world community and the entire United Nations and the entire world criminal court, and it should be demanded that sanctions against the United States are imposed for this crime of genocide, this crime against humanity.
Iran's foreign minister once again dismisses allegations that it has provided drones to Russia to use in the war in Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran's policy regarding the war in Ukraine is refraining from sending weapons to the warring parties. He made the comments in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. The foreign minister also said Tehran respects the territorial integrity of countries and seeks to stop the war and the displacement of people. He called for Ukrainian officials to avoid the influence of some extremist European politicians. Amir Abdullahian also expressed Iran's readiness to hold technical meetings with Ukrainian military experts on the issue of drones. For his part, Dmytro Kubela welcomed Iran's stance and highlighted the importance of technical military talks between the two countries. Russia's defense minister says partial mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine is now complete. Sergei Shoigu says that over a quarter of the draftees have been deployed in the battlefield. He also stressed that no additional mobilization is planned for now. This is the first mobilization of reservists in Russia since World War II. The Russian president ordered the call-up in September after he approved the annexation of four eastern Ukrainian regions. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has expressed doubt that the call-up is finished. He says Moscow may need to send new soldiers to the conflict zone very soon. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent Johnny Miller from Crimea with the latest developments.
Well, last night I was woken up by a series of loud explosions here in Sevastopol. Local authorities say that was the Russian Black Sea Fleet, based, of course, here in Crimea, shooting down Ukrainian drones. It's another indication of how much superior Russian air defense system systems are than their Ukrainian than Ukrainians. Ukrainians, of course, asking, pleading with the West or NATO to give them the most advanced weaponry to help them gain parity on the battlefield with Russia. But the United States particularly is wary at times to give Ukraine their most advanced weapons, worried that some of them might fall into Russian hands, that technology. Also perhaps worried that some of this technology may not be as good as they would hope. Would, for example, the most advanced NATO air defense system be able to shoot down the most advanced Russian missiles? So in terms of, also in terms of this mobilization, Russia, of course, says they've completed the mobilization of 300,000 soldiers. They say about 80,000 of those are already in the battle zone.
Russia is warning against the U.S. plan to bring forward the deployment of upgraded nuclear weapons to Europe. Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushenko said the Kremlin cannot disregard the plan. He added that the accelerated deployment would lower, quote, the nuclear threshold. U.S. media have reported that Washington would speed up its plan to store modernized versions of tactical nuclear weapons at NATO bases in Europe. The reports say that the arms would be delivered in December, several months earlier than planned. The U.S. has around 200 such weapons, with half of those kept at bases in Europe. Russia's warnings come at a time of tensions over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned Western states against supplying weapons to Ukraine. Russia is also strongly opposed to NATO's expansion eastward. South Korean civil leaders demand an end to joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises. The two countries have engaged in the largest military drills in 5 years, with more exercises to continue in November. The drills come amid a rise in tensions following North Korea's recent missile tests. Frank Smith reports.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea, as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week, he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S. and Japan, so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis, with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill. North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Meanwhile, 10,000 jobs are at risk in southern Italy as a refinery will be soon hit by an embargo of Russian oil, which kicks in a few weeks. Meanwhile, the Italian government is working on ways to keep the plant owned by a Russian corporation called Lukoil in business. Max Civelli reports.
Earlier this month, Brussels approved the eighth round of sanctions on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine in an attempt to deprive Moscow of billions of euros in revenues from selling products in the European Union. In a previous round of sanctions, the sixth, Brussels had approved an embargo on Russian seaborne oil that will come into force on December the 5th. This punitive measure will severely affect the ISAB refinery, located on Sicily Island in the south of Italy. The refinery, owned by the Russian multinational energy corporation Lukoil, used to buy about 40% of its feedstock from Moscow. Due to the embargo, the plant could shut down in a few weeks, leaving thousands of people jobless.
These workers have been on permanent employment contracts for many years. They are very worried about what lies ahead. A closure of the refinery would reverberate on the region's satellite activities, affecting about 10,000 workers. We have received assurances from the new government that a positive solution will be found.
Although Lukoil was not singled out by EU sanctions, the ISAB plant, which accounts for around 20% of Italian refining capacity, has been forced to rely solely on Russian oil since international banks are no longer providing the refinery with credit to buy oil from alternative suppliers.
Per quanto riguarda queste sanzioni sul petrolio,
EU financial sanctions usually contain derogation provisions which allow competent authorities to authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited. These provisions should be immediately applied to the ISAB refinery case. This embargo on Russian oil will only have the consequence of further damaging the EU's energy market.
A last shipment of Russian oil is expected to reach the ISAB refinery by December the 5th. The Italian government has a bit over a month to find a solution to the issue. There seems to be two ways only to avert the closure of the ISAB plant. Either the refinery gets nationalized and the Italian government is reportedly mulling over this option, or it is sold to non-Russian buyers. Some media have reported that US private equity fund Crossbridge is among parties interested in buying the refinery. Actually, there is also a third option that could work for ISAB: continue the same way as today. But that would imply a normalization of ties between the EU and Russia, an option that seems non-viable at this stage. Max Civili, Rome.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. But I want you to know that when I talk about the generation that is losing its faith, I am not talking about the younger generation. I am talking about the generation before the youth of today, the older generation of our society. These who believe in some things blindly. Yes, they come to the majlis in the mosque to hear the sermons and storytelling. Yes, they come to the congregational prayers at the mosque, but because none of this is based on reason or logic, they can also be easily convinced to burn down the very same mosque, to trample Imam Hussein, and to give up all their religiosity for those things they think have real value. They do this, and you can see them do this. Today, one of the real crises that we are facing is in the generation before the youth. Those who lack the awareness and understanding of the Muslim youth today, and who sadly also lack the deep, unshakable faith of two generations past. They lack the thoughtfulness and understanding by virtue of which they could nurture a strong and abiding faith in themselves, and are instead held by the bonds of money, position, status, desire, prosperity, and comfort. Nor do they have a strong ark or impregnable fortress like one or two centuries ago, in which, at the very least, they could shelter their faith. even if this was only acquired blindly.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A 100 years ago, these snares for one's thoughts, faith and beliefs did not exist. In those days, the hands of the enemy, those treacherous fingers, had not penetrated so deeply into the fabric of our society. There were still plots which had yet to come to fruition. They still had to deprive people of their fundamental religious faith if they wanted to heap misery on them. But these plots have since succeeded. The generation before the youth, the generation who are no longer young but are rather the youth of yesterday, they are trying to build their faith and belief in the face of a flood without even having a firm foundation on which to build. How lucky are those who chose their faith based on understanding, comprehension, awareness, and knowledge. A flood will sometimes carry off great trees while leaving those tender saplings unscathed because their roots go twice as deep into the grounds. Those things that have a foundation do not shake so easily. They do not fall so easily. In any case, this is a reality that is present in Islam. My brothers, the faith that has value is faith based on understanding, the faith that is joined with comprehension and awareness, faith based on insight, with open eyes, without fear of criticism.
Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traore took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso.
Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with the insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted the coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased, over time, discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri Damiba is planning a counter-offensive from a French base. Protesters have come out in support of the new military leader, while condemning the ousted ruler, who they accused of being a puppet of France.
Damiba is pro-French. He has destroyed Burkina Faso. But thanks to God, we have a great strong man like Ibrahim Traoré to save us all.
Protesters in Burkina Faso have openly expressed support for Russia. Burkina Faso is now turning into a theater of struggle for control between Russia and France and the West in general.
I think, you know, Burkina Faso and this whole region of the Sahel in general is beyond a theater of struggle between Russia and the West. I think this is also a region where there's a heightened dissatisfaction with a long neocolonial system that has been run by France and French allies like the United States and the other NATO countries for a very, very long time. So we see not just here in Burkina Faso, but also we mentioned Mali, but we can talk about Chad, we can talk about protests in Niger, we can even talk about protests in Senegal. We see this whole movement trying to get France out of the Sahel.
Now, we have seen protesters expressing displeasure with the regional bloc ECOWAS after military takeovers in West Africa. Now, is ECOWAS realistic in its approach to coups in the region?
You know, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy within ECOWAS right now. You know, we understand that the goal of ECOWAS and what it promotes are what they claim to be free and fair elections, a certain style of democracy that is encouraged in the region. But we also see some of these people who are taking the most anti-coup stances, like out of Senegal and out of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, who are also constantly under surveillance by the people themselves because of this constant threat of taking illegal third mandates, unconstitutional third mandates to stay in power and to prolong their own positions. So there's kind of this hypocrisy where, on the one hand, ECOWAS is very pro sort of this Western style bourgeois democracy, but on the other hand, also violates that whenever it's convenient for certain neo-colonial factors to stay in power. What is really damaging on ECOWAS's part are when the sanctions are issued in cases like what happened against Mali, because that's not even just targeting the Malian government, that's hurting the people.
The recent events in Burkina Faso are almost similar to what happened in neighboring Mali, where anti-French sentiments run high. The government in Mali believes France is still interfering in the internal affairs of this country, including backing terrorist groups.
I really encourage everybody who is listening to this to go and listen to what Prime Minister Maiga said at the United Nations General Assembly. The accusations against France by the Malian authorities are really quite grave, really quite serious. Beyond just supporting the former president of Mali, we are hearing about the violation of Malian airspace with drones and fighter jets. We are hearing accusations that France has supplied terrorist organizations with arms and ammunition, as well as intelligence information. There was support on France's part of ECOWAS sanctions against Mali as a result of the anti-French government that's currently in power and currently seizes power.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2022, the Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly terrorist groups. Now, how will the instability in Burkina Faso impact on the regional struggle against terrorism in the wider Sahel region?
Well, I think more and more people are understanding that this question of terrorism and this question of neocolonialism are not separate questions, but we have to understand what the roots are of terrorist activity is in this region of the world. I already mentioned the way that the NATO invasion of Libya impacted the Sahel. That led to a huge availability of arms flowing into the direction of the Sahel region. And this is something that people are increasingly aware of. And then, you know, we are talking about the role of France in also helping to sustain some of this terrorist activity, according to what the Malian authorities are currently alleging. And so I think that, you know, there's different ways to look at this question. Stability, we see this as typically a positive thing, but we have to understand that, you know, stability is not always necessarily positive. If it's necessary to disrupt the system that exists a little bit for a period of time, means some form of instability, as long as we can bring that to a place of organization and to a popular form of government, then that's welcome. But what's not welcome is a very stable, long-term neo-colonial system that completely exploits the African people for the benefit of France and for the benefit of Europe.
Well, our guest there says instability, which ushers in a popular government, is preferable than a stable neo-colonial system. I'd like to thank Inem Richardson for her incisive analysis today. We shall now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the patronizing remarks by the U.S. climate envoy, which angered many in Africa. Stay with us.
Kerry angers Africa. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States climate envoy John Kerry has angered many in Africa after arrogantly stating that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects in the continent. Speaking on the sidelines of an African government ministers' conference in Dakar, Senegal last month, Kerry claimed the world is transitioning to renewable energy and that will not be in the interest of Africa investing in gas projects.
Gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Now, to discuss these annoying remarks by John Kerry, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, who is an African team member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can we say the assertion by Kerry that Africa should not invest in long-term gas projects is condescending and imperialistic?
I think so, especially since Kerry is representing the U.S. imperialist state. U.S. imperialism is the greatest threat to life on the planet. It's the force of ecological devastation and disaster. It impacts not only human beings, but also our non-human neighbors and relatives. In fact, you know, the U.S. military is the largest force of ecological devastation that the world has ever known. It's, you know, been robbed through atomic bombs, toxic waste, and untreated sewage that's been dumped by over 800 military bases in over 80 countries. The U.S. Department of Defense actually consumes more oil than any institution in the world. And in the year 2017 alone, the U.S. military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is a carbon footprint greater than of most nations worldwide.
Mohammed Ibrahim, a leading African philanthropist, accused developed countries of hypocrisy in warning Africans against developing natural gas reserves while also eyeing such investments in response to the energy crisis in Europe.
Europe is wallowing in gas. Germany uses a lot of gas. Russian gas, actually half of African gas is exported to Europe. And then we have 600 million people without power. And people say, no. You cannot use gas here. This is morally bankrupt. It's just, that's immoral.
Many African analysts have echoed Mohammed Ibrahim's sentiments, saying efforts by Western powers to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa are the height of hypocrisy.
It's the height of hypocrisy, those efforts to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa, since many of the wealthy countries behind those efforts, like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, include natural gas in their own multi-decade plans to transition to clean energy. Belgium, for example, has doubled its natural gas usage since 1990 and has plans to build even more gas-to-power capacity in the coming years.
While Africa has contributed negligibly to the changing climate with just about 2-3% of global emissions, it stands out disproportionately as the most vulnerable region in the world. Now, this is while, according to Carbon Brief's analysis, the United States is the highest contributor to cumulative carbon dioxide emissions in the world since 1850. Now, Kerry denied that the West and developed nations bear responsibility for climate change and urged every country to bear the burden of its impacts. How true is this statement?
It's not very true. The African continent and much of the third world is already bearing the brunt of climate change, while much of the West, is relatively protected in some cases, right? And the African continent hardly produces any greenhouse gases despite all of that. African people and Africa's non-human inhabitants are paying a heavy price for the environmental crimes of foreign lands like the U.S., like, you know, France and the UK and Japan and others. One resident of the United States has the same climate footprint as 27.5 Senegalese people.
The West is insisting that Africa forgoes the gas, oil, and coal at its disposal due to climate change. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, speaking recently at the country's independence celebrations, slammed European Union Parliament for demanding that the country should halt its East Africa crude oil pipeline project.
Recently, there was yet another manifestation of imperialistic arrogance and hegemonism by elements in the European Parliament, whereby they decreed from Brussels that East African crude pipeline should not be constructed until those arrogant actors permit us to do so.
The insistence by U.S. climate envoy John Kerry and the EU Parliament that African countries should halt their fossil fuel development projects is seen by many as a deliberate attempt by Western countries to prevent Africa's industrialization, which will eventually stop over-reliance to the West.
I think we should note that it's not just industrialization that caused climate change. It's really the extractive practices of multinational corporations, largely based in the West, and the devastation of, you know, Western militaries, and particularly those like the U.S. military that brought about climate change. And so the false narrative that, you know, the West is trying to push helps them argue that Africa and a lot of the third world should forgo industrialization. And that's basically a death sentence for African countries.
Delegates from over 50 countries participated in a pre-COP27 meeting held in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Climate activists praised the progress made and want to make sure that previous promises are kept. The country's environment minister said that Africa must be allowed to exploit its resources.
The 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as the COP27 Summit, will be held at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in November. Now, what's your projection on this meeting? Are we going to see major split between the West and Africa?
And the success of that domination has always depended on the complicity of an intermediate class of the colonized. Those forces represent a central pillar of the colonial order. They're really just servants to, you know, their imperialists or neocolonial masters. And so for that to change, there has to be some sort of serious class struggle on the African continent against these servants we call, you know, heads of state or their, and their contemporaries, the compradors, the African ruling class. And I think without that class struggle, there won't be a major split at the COP27 summit. There'll only be minor statements of grievance, like we're seeing, you know, today with certain folks kind of speaking out.
Now, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has expressed readiness to work with other willing partners in the country's oil pipeline project after the European Union expressed opposition to the development of the country's oil resources. Let's take a listen.
East Africa, therefore, should not worry about those arrogant people, that those arrogant people can stop the oil project in East Africa. If any actor tries to delay our project, we shall decisively deal with that betrayal according to the relevant laws. We shall develop all the aspects of the project with willing partners. Initially, I was not interested in the pipeline. I was only interested in the refinery to produce petrol, diesel, aviation fuel for East African market. It is Total who insisted, even when Uganda had to give away US dollars 20.7 per barrel to use the pipeline. In the end, we support the pipeline because it contributes something modest to our Tanzanian sisters and brothers who, under Mwalimu's leadership, contributed so much to Africa, including Uganda, in the anti-colonialism effort. Besides, the pipeline corridor provided by the Tanzanian government will bring to us gas from Tanzania and Mozambique because our gas resources are not that big. We need gas for fertilizer manufacture, to produce chemicals, etc. Therefore, down with the imperialists. parasitic murderers.
Now, what option do African countries have if Western oil multinationals and financial institutions withdraw from fossil energy projects in Africa?
Western oil multinationals and, you know, international or Western financial institutions are largely responsible for the current climate catastrophe that Africa and much of the colonized world is experiencing. What African countries need is debt cancellation. They need debt cancellation and reparations for the decades, even, you know, centuries of work that these institutions and corporations have done to impoverish African people and intensify that climate catastrophe that they're facing at this moment on the African continent and really throughout the world.
Well, there you have it. Western colonial powers actually owe African countries billions of dollars for crimes they committed against African people over the past centuries. This is the money that Africa needs to develop and attain self-sufficiency. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tunde Osazua, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have an expert from the Islamic House of Qom, Hojjatul Islam, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Karimi. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the ways to control our lust and sexual drive. We know that according to the Islamic teachings, there are some recommendations in order to control your sexual desires, or it's better to say carnal desires. Of course, sexual relations, sexual intercourse are not abundant. They are, we can say, even recommended by, in its, we can say, legitimate, lawful Islamic framework. Now, first, let's start with the definition of shahwa or lust. According to Islamic teachings, what is shahwa or lust?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So shahwa is referring to whatever one may desire. So some people have the desire and shahwa for wealth. Some for, sexual desires. Some for fame. So for each and everyone, that desire might be manifested in, something different from the other people.
Yes.
But usually when we are talking about shahwa, people, refer to that shahwa, that desire, which is related to carnal desires and the sexual desires. So the first one that I would like to share is that we should not think that this is, nowadays, this is the question asked only by Muslims or by religious people. No, it's a widespread problem in all the societies, and we see that the scholars, the scientists, they write papers and books for people out there to control their lust.
Yes.
So we shouldn't think that's only an Islamic problem. No,
yes.
I mean, youth in all, maybe almost all the countries, all
yes.
the cities, we have people suffering from that.
Yes.
And especially because of the fact that we see the rate of marriage
yes.
getting very low in all the countries. So people have problems in mm-hmm. controlling their sexual desires.
We have sex addictions, for example, nowadays, or pornography addictions,
exactly.
you know. These are the problems of the modern world. That's
and
right.
This is not the solution
mm-hmm.
encouraged by the, I mean, even scientists.
Yes.
Because of the harms. I mean, for people looking for such ways.
Yes.
So, but the point is that when it comes to all the scholars, those scientists, they just try to give recommendations for the people, but all the recommendations are related to this world. But
yes.
when it comes to religious scholars, that doesn't make any difference. Christians, Muslims, doesn't make any difference. We have more recommendations here because we have, I mean, recommendations related to the hereafter too,
yes.
and which are taken from the infallible Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. This is the first point. The second point is exactly what you mentioned, that Islam is not against shahwa as an instinct. So
yes.
when it is created, it means that, I mean, it should be, I mean, we are in need of it. And the protection of the generation is through the same sexual desire. But
that's right.
there must be a channel for it. And the, maybe the main channel or the only channel is through marriage. So unlike some, I mean, schools and religions and denominations, Islam does not suppress this desire altogether, but
that's right.
says that there is a framework for it. The third point is that when we are talking about the ways to control lust, it is for sure easier said than done. And having said that, the other point for the people in our time is that the more difficult the job is, the more reward you will earn.
Okay.
So
right.
this is a principle.
Okay.
So we shouldn't think that a person living in an Islamic country, in an Islamic city, and he's
no,
or she's,
so. Okay.
I mean...
away from the carnal desires.
Exactly.
Or shahwa, because it is an instinct put in the nature of all human beings. And as you said, nowadays, because of the social media and cell phones
mm-hmm.
and all the things, you know, well, one of the main motivators of the shahwa, which
exactly.
are, we can say, the nude pictures are all available. But what are the precise recommendations for those who want to be away from such things? In Islam, we have the concept of taqwa, we have the concept of fasting and prayer the Muslims are obliged to do, and all the things are made to be considered as an obstacle
yeah.
on the way to control our shahwa. What about the other ways?
Sure. Just one last point.
Okay.
As I mentioned, my point was that we can imagine two people, one living in a Muslim country, Islamic region, Islamic city, if we may put it this way, and one living in a Western country with all those attractions.
Yes.
So for sure, the second one has more problems. So we shouldn't think that they may, if both of them, they're practicing chastity, they may have the same reward. No, for sure, the one who is living in a non-Muslim country with all those attractions, if he or she is able to protect themselves, then they may have more reward compared to the people who may not have the same difficulties and problems.
Okay.
And in one narration, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that according to that narration, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala boasts of a young person who leaves his or her carnal desires because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Now, let's go to the solutions. The first point is that, and this is, I think, is shared by both religious and non-religious, scholars, especially for the youth and for the teens who are not married, to be away from imaginations, too much imaginations, especially before going to sleep. So, and it is also encouraged for the people that try not to go to bed before you are, too tired. So one of the best opportunities for the Satan to deceive the people is before people go to sleep. Before they fall in sleep, and they may go. They may think about different issues, and this power of imagination help Satan to deceive them in an easier way. So they are encouraged, the youth, the teens, to be away from such imaginations. Like you may, take a book to read some pages, and it is, well-known sentence that as soon as you take a book to read, then you will fall asleep. So it might be one way for some people. It might be some games through their cell phone, for example, or watching TV and so on and so forth. My point is that this power of imagination, especially in our time, is too strong, and people should be away from that and think of some solutions to replace that time spent for imagination.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So you mean by imagination is not, for example, thinking about sexual drives,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Related to that. That's all right.
The next point is haram looks and forbidden looks, which is very important. And maybe in our time, one of the most dangerous ways for our sexual desires to go to, deviation is haram and forbidden looks. So why people are deceived by Satan and they commit several sins which are related to sexual desires? Maybe one of the main reasons is that they are not careful about their looks. This has been mentioned in the Quran and in the narrations. For example, in the Quran, both men and women are asked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to cast down their looks. قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنْ قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَقُضُّوا مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ. And in one narration, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying that the haram look is one of the poisonous arrows of Iblis or the Satan. So if you, close your eyes not to look at forbidden sins because of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then Allah will give you a kind of faith that you have not tasted before. So again, I'm putting emphasis on the fact that this is not an easy job, but people need to practice. How? There are some ways, for example, through muhasaba, musharata, muraqaba, which are mentioned as one of the most practical ways by the scholars. So, for example, if you are a person suffering from this problem, you commit this sin a lot, you may, first of all, do musharata. Early in the morning, like after morning prayer, you say that, "Oh Allah, today I will take care of my looks." And you may add that, "Oh Allah, if I look at forbidden sin, for example, I will pay $10 in charity if it is difficult for you." During the day, you do muraqaba, and at night, you do muhasaba, meaning that you take your actions into account. Were you able to act upon that condition with, what you said to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? If not, then you may pay charity, which might be difficult for you. Or you may tell Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I will fast the following day, which might be difficult. So the next day you do the same, the next day. And so you will see that after maybe some weeks, at least you have committed this sin much less than before. The third point is that, which many people unfortunately take it very lightly, is the effect of haram music. In our time, we have some kinds of forbidden music which directly provoke the people sexually speaking.
Yes.
And I believe that no one can deny the effect of music